Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene Podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. This week it's part two of the A to Z of snooker. In the previous edition, we went from A to D. This week we've made it through from E to I. I've been joined by Neil Folds for the duration. Phil Yates had to duck out about halfway through. Alan McManus joined us a bit late. Hope you enjoy it. So E is for 80s, as in the 1980s. Obviously, the boom period in the UK. Still sort of romanticised by people of a certain age, but I guess it's because if you were sort of lived through that era, you couldn't get away from snooker. I mean, obviously, Neil, you were a top player during it. What were your sort of memories of being a celebrity, really?
Well, I think I must be very fortunate to have played snooker during that era, because it was the best time to be playing. You know, I mean, I turned pro, I was just 19, coming up 20. So I played through the from 84 onwards, right through that era. The best times of my playing life, for sure, you know. And the game was big. There wasn't the same, without putting the other side to it, there wasn't the same options for television, was there? You know, there were three or four channels, I think Channel 4 was invented then. And it was live sport when you weren't seeing much live sport. You never used to see live football, did you, for instance, at that time?
Very little.
The FA Cup final was a bigger in the year than the Champions League final. But so you're watching live sport, and also there were heroes and villains in the game, and I think that's what people loved, you know. I mean, without going on about it, the time when I beat Alex Higgins, I've got loads of mail. Some was like, how dare you beat Alex? And some saying, wonderful, great, glad you beat him. Didn't like him. So that was, I was lucky to be involved in all that side of it. You know, but there were the big rivalries, you know, in the game, and people loved it. You watched snooker because you wanted someone to win and you wanted someone to lose. I mean, as much as I love all the ambassadors in the game now, and there are some, as we know, you know, if everyone's a nice, consummate, polished professional playing another consummate, polished professional, people that don't really have that same age when they watch it, but that was all there then, you know, and the game was big, and Barry had his Matchroom, and we played snooker all over the world. So yeah, the 80s were big, and I feel very fortunate to have been some kind of a part of it, albeit not the, you know, not a Jimmy White big part of it, but I did play my part, and I was lucky enough to be there.
The thing is, I think sports coverage now on the telly is better than ever, like what Sky and Eurosport and all the other channels do, but when it was just BBC and ITV, sports stars were proper stars, everybody knew them.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when the theme music used to come on, it was like, whoa, fantastic, you know, it's the Crucible or whatever. I mean, I'll break the 80s into two very different segments, really. One negative, one positive. I mean, as you say, great word to describe it, romanticised. The standard then was pretty, you know, well below what it is now in terms of the lower ranked players. Yeah. There's no doubt about it. I mean, they were nowhere near the guys now. Obviously, the top end, very different. I think one of the great things that made it, though, was that most of the players, or certainly a very large proportion of them, had had a life before snooker. They understood what it was like to have a job, and so they really appreciated what they were actually doing. You know, people like Ryan and Spencer, and well, the list goes on and on and on. They'd had jobs, they knew how tough it was in the real world. So suddenly they were placed in this fantasy world, and you know, that's what made it so good.
But also, it permeated the culture, didn't it? Because, I mean, Steve, for example, went on the Morecambe and Wise show, the biggest show on TV, and lots of other shows, and snooker players were like, I suppose, the comparison now is people on reality TV. You just knew them. You knew their faces. They were there in the culture.
Very interesting way of putting it. Yeah, it was like reality TV, wasn't it? You know, because of that, you know, and interestingly, I know you're going to say something else now, but you could probably get a ticket to go to the Crucible a lot easier than you can now, strangely enough. You know, it wasn't the same, people just desperately trying to get in to see it. It was more on the television. It wasn't so much for the snooker fans as it is now, a lot of it. It was just for the general public. They just loved the game, didn't they?
And it was a real education for me, actually. One specific thing about the 80s that taught me a lot about British society, and not a part of it I actually like, is the fact that Steve Davis was the actual model professional. He was brilliant at the game. He did absolutely nothing wrong whatsoever on the table, and so many people wanted him to lose. It was like this sort of jealous collective streak in people. You know, he's winning everything, we don't like that. And I remember being a youngster then, thinking, well, why don't they like him? Because what's he ever done to them? All he's done is do positive things, and yet he created that negative vibe.
Do you remember the Masters match between Alex Higgins and Steve Davis at the Conference Centre? And it was best of nine those days, and it was 4-4. Both players left the arena. Bear in mind, this was in London, you know, this is where Steve, a lot of his friends would have been around there. Alex came back to a big cheer. When Steve came back in, they booed him. Yep. They booed him. Yep, yep. About literally hundreds of people booed him. What has Steve ever done wrong to deserve it, except for just be really good at what he did?
Is the answer.
Yeah, yeah, that was all it was.
Yeah, I think as well that the sort of the way it was treated by TV, it was kind of more innocent. I mean, now everything is hyped in every sport. Everything is treated like the biggest deal ever because, of course, the TV companies are trying to keep viewers. So at the start of a normal snooker programme, there'll be like a minute-long sort of package, which, by the way, is taking about 3 hours to put together by the talented people who do it. But in those days, I was watching on YouTube the end of the 84 final when Davis beat Jimmy, 18-16, had been that great comeback. And there's no arena interview. They don't go in the arena interview them. It just cuts back to the studio. Quite an anonymous studio. It was done in the practice room in those days. There's Viney, I think it's Virgo and Willie Thorne, just sat there. And they talk about the match, and then there's a plate of sandwiches just on the table. And David said, because I'd overrun the slot, David Vine said, yeah, the floor manager brought us some sandwiches to eat. All very kind of, it's not like the world final at all. It's just, okay, well, we've done that, and it's kind of over. But what was funny was he then said, well, it's a great final, and next year's will have to go something to beat this. Well, of course, next year's was 1985. And inevitably, we're going to mention that, Phil. I mean, that was the kind of zenith of the whole soap opera, wasn't it?
And it was the yoke that continues to be around the neck of snooker because people always say, you know, if you quote a viewing figure to them, which is a very good figure, they'll say, yeah, but it's not 18.4 million or whatever it was, you know, because that's the figure that is quoted time and time again, particularly by critics of snooker in the media. You've got to remember back then the 3-4 channels, that was it. Even though, you know, 18.4 million was still a remarkable figure. And I think it remains the largest after midnight audience for any programme.
Yeah, and BBC Two audience. But, of course, now the World Final gets 50, 60 million because it goes all around the world.
Yes, exactly. So,
and that's the problem, isn't it? Because people just think about a UK sport. Yeah, yeah, okay, you're never going to get those figures over here. But, like you say, it's watched around the world by a lot of people. So, surely that's better, isn't it?
Mm. You'd think so.
There wasn't a single century in that final. And had it been a sort of 18-11, 18-10 Davis win, which it probably should have been, you know, no one would ever recall it. It was just, the finish was just so engrossing.
Yes. Okay, well, let's move on to F, which is an exciting topic, foul and a miss. This is the miss rule, which changed in the early 90s, I think, to the three misses, and you lose the frame if you can see a ball directly. And it's one of those rules that has its critics, but what was interesting was a few years ago, the players were asked if they'd like to change it. There was a vote, and actually, they didn't. So whatever problems they have with it, no one could think of maybe a better way of getting round a player, I guess, just deliberately missing.
Well, I'll start this, but Neil's the real expert on this because he played under this rule.
I should just say Alan McManus is about to join us.
Come on, Alan.
he'll enjoy this topic, but come on. Yeah.
So, before the rule was changed, it was abused like you would not believe. I'm not going to name names, your favourite phrase, name names. I'm not going to do that, but it was abused.
Names, Phil.
Yeah, yeah.
It was or at least write them down so we can see them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was abused, there's no doubt about it. And while the
I should just say to Alan, we're talking about the foul and a miss rule.
Oh. Yeah, and while the current rule is not perfect, it's infinitely better than it was before it was changed. Infinitely better.
So, yeah, we'll throw you right in the deep end, Alan, you just sat down. Foul and a miss rule, I mean, from a player's perspective, is it kind of about right, do you think?
I think it's perfect. I think it's perfect. I think the way that I, to prove that it's perfect, when was the last time there was a controversial ruling in a big match? I can't remember one, really. And the players know 99.9% of the time you've got to hit the ball on, unless it's like, I mean, I have seen a couple of times, I remember Michaela, when she was refereeing at the World Qualifying a few years ago, and I can't remember the player, it might have been Jamie Jones actually, he played out, it was a really tough one, and it was a brilliant effort, he didn't make contact and she didn't call a miss, and it was a brilliant call, and Jamie's opponent, I think it was Jamie, his opponent never put up any sort of argument, and after the match actually I went to Michaela and I said, listen, I said, that well done, that was a brilliant decision that you made, and credit to her, but it doesn't happen very often.
It could be though an argument against laying a really good snooker, because if it's an average snooker you should escape from it, it will be called. If it's a fiendish vile snooker, the referee might not call it, but then I suppose you could say, well, what's the point in getting in a really tough snooker? It doesn't matter to you because you can get out of it, but
I think it's a brilliant rule. I think the nature of people, the nature of a lot of snooker people these days, not the players, but I know people back home and they moan about it. Oh, the miss rule's terrible. They want something to complain about, but there isn't anything to complain about with the miss rule. I think it's superb. At pro level, amateur level's different, obviously, because you don't have a referee generally. So you get arguments over put that back and all this business. But at the top level, it's ideal.
Do you think, though, Neil, that like you can get a snooker that's worth like 40 points? Is that right, do you think?
I don't know. There may be a way of tweaking that, but I don't know it. I mean, there's only so many points that you... I don't really like it when someone maybe would be 10 in front, for example, on one red, and they're in a nasty snooker, and the next thing, they need snookers. You know, it's possible. That would be a lot of balls missed in a row. So I think that the point Alan makes is a good one, that referees need to use their discretion and not just blindly call a miss all the time. If there's one ball to hit and you miss it by a fraction... and it's a difficult snooker, then it shouldn't be put back. And so Michaela did. I remember there was a match in the UK the year David Grace got to the semi-finals of the UK, which would have been the year Neil Robertson won it, 2015, I think. Martin Gould and David Grace played a match where I think in the last frame David Grace was in a very bad, very difficult snooker, and I think it was Terry Camilleri who didn't call a miss, and I think it was a great decision, a bit like that, you know. Whereas and after the match I interviewed Martin Gould because it was seen a bit controversial because he might have won the match there and then he lost it. He said I abide by the referee's decision. I thought that was very good of him actually, and I think it was a good decision. So the referees need to have the ability to show discretion and use common sense on that rule, I think. Otherwise, the rule works better, certainly better than when players used to deliberately miss. And Phil's going to name those names in a short while of the people that he thinks were the offenders.
I actually just wonder, would a good rule be, instead of three misses and you lose the frame, three misses and ball in hand?
When there's
a full ball on.
I was wondering that. I was watching the snooker last night. It was Karen Wilson, Judd Trump as we record this. And I was kind of just idly thinking that. Would that actually be a better solution? It would speed things up. I don't know.
What you've got to do, I think, you've got to try it for a tournament.
Yeah.
Maybe not the World Championship, the UK, a tournament, and say, because there's always going to be something you hadn't thought. Changing the rules is a very dangerous thing in any sport, because you can end up with a ludicrous situation. It's happened in cricket, in a lot of sports. So it's worth giving it a short-term go, and if it doesn't work, then just scrap it and go back.
I'm too cowardly to name names, but the colour...
Well, while this is recording, you are.
Yeah.
Singing like a canary when it's turned on.
Exactly. well, the colour of a canary and the colour that denotes cowardice is yellow.
Nice.
And the one I always remember is on the yellow in a very high-profile match.
Nice segue.
In the 1980s. Very high-profile. No name's going to be mentioned, and it was one of the most extraordinary things I've ever seen. Now, that would not be allowable. It would be a miss all day and every day. And that's the frame of reference before the rule was changed and after. What's better? And there's no doubt about it, what's better is now.
I actually remember my first time at the Crucible. I lost to the Griff, and deep in the match, it was either 12 each or he was 12-11 in front. And he played a miss. He didn't play a deliberate miss as such, but he played it. There was about six reds on, and he played a gap that Terry can find, and the cue balls come back into bulk. But now it would go back 1,000,000%. And I'm not saying it cost me the match, because it didn't, but it certainly helped me losing the match in the end. But he wouldn't have gotten away with that now. But Terry didn't do anything wrong.
I'm not blaming the people who took advantage of the rule, because probably everybody did, but the point was the rule was to be taken advantage of, and now you can't take advantage of it.
No. Okay, before I call a miss, let's move on to G. Now, G, and we're fine ones to talk, G is for geeks. And what I mean by geeks, I want to mention some of the people who have helped the game in terms of what they do online. The first two snooker websites that I was aware of, one was Global Snooker Centre, which Janie Watkins ran very diligently for years before World Snooker even had a website. And if you wanted to follow like qualifying results and so on, you went on there. And around the same time, Herman Ardlam, a Norwegian, set up snooker.org, which is still running now and still a great resource. And of course, in more recent times, we have Q-Tracker, run by the great Ron Florax, which is an extraordinary site. Incredible stuff on there. Me and Neil were looking at it last week. There was a stat on there. The average century in terms of the number of centuries you've had. So, for example, if you've made one century and it was 120, your average is 120. No, why anyone needs to know that, we couldn't work out, but it was just extraordinary to find that stuff.
Because Ronnie is nowhere near the top of that list, because he's made so many, and some of them will be hundreds.
You were above Ronnie.
I was above Ronnie, so I think in some way I must be a better player.
Yeah, in some ways, yeah. but what I'm trying to say is, these people, Phil, I mean, I know you and I are on these websites a lot, and we should also mention Chris Downer, who's less online, but he does his Crucible Almanac. So these people who, in their own time, and they're not getting any money for it, have helped snooker fans and indeed people within the game do their jobs.
The three people you've mentioned, the two website guys and Chris Downer, have just improved the quality of our life. It's as simple as that. They've made our job so much easier, and they've made us sound so much better than we are. They've made us sound much more well-informed than we are, because we're getting all the stuff from them. So I thank them every single day of my life. I'll give you one very topical example. We were here at the Champion of Champions yesterday. I went onto Q Tracker to do some research on the match I was commentating on, and he's got the birthdays up there, and it's got Ian Barry Stark, brackets 76 on it. It was Barry's birthday. I went into the next room. There was Barry. I shook hands with him and said, "Happy birthday, Barry." He went, "How did you know?" And I said, "Q Tracker." You know, I'd never have known in a month of Sundays before that website. Mm. So they're absolutely brilliant, and thank you.
And also, it's like a kind of museum of stats, isn't it? You know, it's all there. If you want to look up at an idle moment, Alan, your career record, it's there.
Yeah. And some people, we call it havering in Scotland, like lying. Sort of, you know, some people embellish their records and say, "Yeah, I beat him and I beat him." You can go, "No, you didn't. No, you didn't." And that has happened a lot, and a couple of boys in the club.
What happens is people just add a few little stats on there, say, "I've made four centuries in that match." You look up, they made one and a break of 80, and you think, you know, hang on, you can't get away with that. But
hold on a minute. Name names. You've got to say that to him as well as me. don't leave him out. He's not going to name them, but just ask him.
No, I mean, I follow cricket, and there's a guy called Andrew Sampson who's the most brilliant statistician in cricket. He comes up with all kinds of wonderful stats, and snooker's going that way, and they like doing it, as you say. They do it for their own interest, because some people are very, very interested in the stats. Some people just can't bear it. And I remember going through the almanac with Jimmy White for Eurosport, the World Championships, and he looked at it and he said, "I do not want to see that," because he just can't bear it. He doesn't know anything, and he doesn't want to know, which is fine, isn't it? You know, he's all over it. Some of the things in there about him, not interested. But I love it, you know, and that's great. That some people love the stats, and I think all of these people are just brilliant, and they get so much enjoyment out of it.
I remember actually being in the club. It would have been early 90s, obviously pre-internet, and as we all know, and the punters would know. One of my best mates was playing a match. It was a big match at a venue, and he was playing Joe Johnson, and the club, the telly wasn't working or something, so we'd no page 387 on CFAX or whatever it was, and I had to go into the pub along the road, because they had, what was it, it wasn't CFAX, it was so is it alright if I check your TV? And she said, "Well, no, you need to buy a drink." But I was in practice, and it was the afternoon. Yeah, yeah. I said, "Okay, I'll have a fresh orange and lemonade." She gave me the clicker, I checked it, and I got the result. But otherwise, you couldn't. Actually had to phone the venue or whatever.
That's right.
So times have changed, and for the better.
Yeah. I'm going to mention the Crucible Almanac, because Neil, it's a bit like the Christmas radio times to you, isn't it? I mean, when that World Championship's on, you're not party from it, are you?
No, that's right. And I've got my almanac already for... For the Crucible in 2019, and you know, Chris Downer, he's updated it. I guess the first time he did it, compiled it, that was the difficult time, wasn't it? To get it all in. Now
it's
updating
starting,
it,
isn't it? Yeah.
Update it would probably take him 2 or 3 weeks now, but yeah. I think it's wonderful.
Okay, just to say Phil Yates has to step out to do some actual work, but we'll carry on with H. It can only be for Hendry, Stephen Hendry. In the last podcast, we talked about the great Steve Davis and all he achieved and the standards he set, and then of course in the 90s. Someone came along and set even higher standards. Incredible.
Yeah. Funny, I was talking to Stephen about this the other night. The first time I met him properly was the spring of 90. I was down at Pontins in Prestatyn. And, it was World Championship time. And I had won the Scottish Amateur Championship a few weeks before it. We were down for the home internationals. And I'd never even met Stephen. And he won the World Championship, obviously, on the Monday for his first time. We were in the Clwyd Bar in Prestatyn, and someone tapped me on the shoulder, and I turned round, it was a busy old place. I turned round and it was Stephen. He'd won the world championship the day before for the first time, his first world title. And he said, "Hi Alan, I'm Stephen." He shook my hand, he said, "Well done winning the Scottish Amateur." And I said, "You kind of won something like yesterday that was quite important." And I said, "You know, well done to him." That was my first sort of meeting with him. You know, it was cool.
Yeah, the year he turned professional 16, didn't he? And there was a lot, I hadn't seen him play, actually. I didn't see him when he was in the Star of the Future thing at Pontins. I'd heard he was good. But there was mutterings that he turned professional too young. That's what they were saying. And in his first year, we were playing in the Mercantile Classic, which was up at Warrington. And I'd won my first match, can't remember who I played. But my next match, I'm playing, for the first time ever, Silvino Francisco or Stephen Hendry. And at the time, I thought, well, I haven't played Silvino, he's a decent player. Been quite good if he lost, actually, you know, and play the other guy, who I don't know much about, Hendry. I've told Stephen this story. Yeah. Anyway, Stephen beat him. Now, that's the only time I ever beat Stephen, by the way. I beat him 5-4, but I had to play one of the best breaks of my life in the decider. I could not believe how good he was. Yeah. He was just amazingly good. And after the match, I had to see the press, and I said, "Oh, look, I can't. What a fantastic player he is." And I remember Willie Thorne come up to me after and he said, why are you giving that boy credit? He said, "Not, don't know if he's going to be good enough." See, I'm naming names, you see.
Yeah, yeah.
I said, I think he's brilliant. And actually, Stephen's mother wrote me a letter and said, "You were very kind to my son. It was very kind of you." She wrote me a letter and it delivered to my house. And now she got the address, but she said how kind you were to my son. So that's my first memory, and I never beat him again. So there you are.
No more letters.
He kind of a famously, as a kid, he won the Scottish Amateur Championship twice in a row. He beat, I think one of them he beat a guy called Stuart Nevis, and the other one he beat a kind of legend in Scottish snooker, Jimmy McNellan. And the final, I don't know where it was, but the story goes, and Stephen was only, I think, 15 at the time, 14 or 15. Now, back then, you didn't have anyone who was anyway decent at that age, because it was all older guys. It was a pub club game. But Stephen had this talent anyway. So he played in the amateur final, and I think he was 7-2 down. It was best of 17. I think he was 6-2 or 6-1 or something like that behind. And he came off after the first session, and the legend goes that he said, "Right, I've got him now. I know how to beat him."
Yeah.
And he did. He beat him. I think it was 9-8 he beat him. And those stories kind of circulate around the Scottish clubs, and we all know about them up north. But I think it was amazing.
I think what's interesting, though, is like he's not often sort of lumped in with the natural talents. But when you look at it, he first played, he was a Christmas present, he got a snooker table in 1981. 4 years later, he was a pro. You know, he was actually, and then he played at the Crucible in his first year.
Yeah.
And played a complete, that was the thing with Hendry, he played a completely different style of game. He just went for everything, didn't he? And he's ushered in now this attacking era, because everyone that's come through after him has tried to copy him, basically.
Yeah, I mean, that first season, he lost to Obi Agrawal in the UK Championship. Now, he was a billiards player, wasn't he, and a half-decent one. But so he had a long way to go then. But after that, what you realise, the man, is he's as hard as nails on the table, completely, I was going to say a mercenary. What do I mean by that? He only wanted to win at snooker, a bit like Steve Davis, same mentality. The money meant nothing to him. The fame meant nothing to him. You get that in sport, people that just want to be the best. Yeah. And they just want to stay the best, and everything that goes with it doesn't really stop them. Some people, it stops them, you know, when they get money and they drive around in a nice car. And I mean, Stephen had nice things, but you knew that wasn't what spurred him on. And that's why he became such a great player, because he just wanted to be good at that and nothing else, you know. And the only one I can think of, there's some great players now. I think, well, Mark Selby's the nearest thing to it now, I would say. Someone that just wants to win at snooker.
Yeah.
You know, the others are great players, but they have other things in their life.
I also remember, I said there the first time I met him properly, I also went to watch him do an exhibition. He must have been maybe 17, I was about 15. And you could see straight away, I mean, I remember it was on table 13 in the club that I played in. They did this exhibition, and within the first frame I'm looking and I said, "Oh, this guy is just ridiculous." And you sort of know, don't you? You just know. I could play a little bit, I was decent. I'd seen a lot of guys who were good, you know, younger players coming through with a boom the boom era of the mid-80s, but when I watched them live, I thought, oh, this is just something different.
But the only thing with Stephen is, maybe did he retire too quickly? I mean, you know, in his last season, his last tournament, he beat John Higgins in the World Championships, albeit it wasn't a great match either, actually, and lost heavily to Steve Maguire, I think, really heavily. But, you know, could he have gone on 5 years? Probably, if he wasn't going to be top dog, the answer would be no. To be a top 16 player, top 32 player, like Steve Davis, did drop down, doesn't suit Stephen. That's why maybe he stopped when he did.
I find it amazing now when you think back to, I think I'm right in saying he said he developed this yip thing, yeah, or whatever it was in about 2001, roughly.
Shame it wasn't a few years before.
Yeah, true. I know. I would have won a couple of bob. But it's amazing that he almost masked it, or he hid it. Not hid it. It's his property. It's his thing. But he didn't mention it for about 10 years until, you know, he stopped playing in the heads and chaos and all this kind of thing. So he must have really had some tough times for how good he was through the 90s. You go into the noughties and he, you know, for comparison with what he was doing then, it must have been torture for him in a way.
But I guess there'll be some newer snooker fans who don't really remember him in his prime, and there's a tendency to kind of dismiss an era you haven't really been part of. But make no mistake, he did change the game, and he was, like Phil said in the last podcast, Davis, when he won his sixth world title, was the best thing snooker had ever seen. There's no doubt when Hendry, probably well before he'd won his seventh, was the best. Now, you can argue now, maybe Ronnie O'Sullivan's overtaken him or whatever, but we should not detract from his achievements, because they were extraordinary.
They were. I mean, I've got so many memories, as we all do. I remember going to a Regal Masters final 1 year in Motherwell, and Stephen played the Griff actually in the final, and he beat him 10-1, and Griff was lucky to get one. Quite honestly, he was that good. It was, and you knew turning up, I remember going to watch it, you knew what the score was going to be. You knew it was going to be a landslide win, and he did it. He seemed to do it all the time. He was that good.
Let's quickly, because I know you've got to go and work, let's quickly try I. I is for India, because that's where snooker started. That's where snooker was invented. That's so the sort of mythology goes, at the Ooty Club. And Dennis Taylor told me he actually went there. He was doing some reality show set in India, the Real Marigold Hotel or something. And they went to the Ooty Club. It was a 3-hour journey to get there. He wasn't very happy when he got there. But he said he played on the original table. It's been reclothed, I'm guessing, since 1875. But he said, actually, it was quite an emotional experience, because, you know, everything that's happened since basically is down to that. And I think we probably all say that, really. Have you played out there, Alan?
I've been twice in the last probably 3 or 4 years for the Indian Open, Mumbai, and can't remember the other one. I didn't do very well, but obviously it's got a huge billiards background, yeah, with the Geet Sethis and all the guys from 70s, 80s and Ferreras and all these names, although I think it's East African, it could be. But and then Pankaj, obviously, yeah. Pankaj Advani in recent years. I was actually amazed he's obviously world champion X amount of times in billiards, but what a snooker player he was. I thought he was superb. And you could see when you played him, I played him I think 3 times, you could tell he was a billiard player, the way he played snooker. And they've obviously got a rich history. I unfortunately, as I say, I've only been a couple of times, but we're all aware of it. I think everyone in snooker is.
There's a lot of interest in the game over there. We went over there in the 80s, or maybe about 1990. It was one of Barry's trips. So anyway, the year I can't remember. We played in Thailand, Hong Kong, and we finished off in India. Stephen was on that trip actually, because I remember we played the tournament in the hotel, and they actually, Stephen nearly lost to a guy called Sunik Multani. Do you remember him? Good player, big thick glasses. He had Stephen beaten, but there was a huge, you couldn't get anywhere near the table. There was a massive interest in the game. I ended up losing to Davis in the tournament. And they really appreciated good snooker. They really appreciated it. It was a really good event. So that we go back. I mean, you think, though, going back, really, when you think about how the game was invented, there must have been drink involved, would you say? You know, they got a few billiard balls, and they think, well, bored with this. Let's drink a bit of find Port.
You'd hope so, because that's been a tradition in snooker as well.
Well, it has, but you know, they must have, they've invented a game there, and they think, oh, put all these balls on the table.
Well, it's attributed to Colonel Neville Chamberlain, but he wasn't a colonel at the time. He was 19 years of age, yeah. so the story goes. Became a colonel later in life. And Chris Downer, who we mentioned earlier from the Crucible Almanac, he tracked down his grave, took a picture of his grave. I'm not quite sure where it was.
That's niche.
That is very niche, but it's kind of, yeah. But he's like, little did he know that year, like 100 and so years on, we'd be sat here recording a podcast. There were no podcasts, so how would he know?
No, but it's...
Am I right in thinking that the word snooker actually come from the army cadets or something over in India?
It was an insult that I think that the officers gave the younger like members of the army. So imagine what it could have been called.
Yeah, and it has been called by a lot of you.
And on that bombshell, we will conclude. The A to Z of snooker will continue at some point with the letter J.